I welcome everybody to this presentation that has been transferred from tomorrow to today because we still have some problems in opening the platform which you will use tomorrow. I've changed the title of my presentation today a bit. I will be talking about thematic subcorpora in a diachronic corpus, and this will be mostly dealing with Georgian materials. First of all, a few preliminaries concerning the question, what is a diachronic corpus? The example I will use is the Georgian National Corpus, which we am trying to establish in the project together with many colleagues from Georgia, a project that has been funded by the Volkswagen Foundation since 2012, and which will hopefully be funded in another 3 years' time. A diachronic corpus is a corpus that extends over time. That means, in the case of Georgian, a corpus that covers the whole range of the transmission of Georgian textual materials from the beginning of Georgian literacy up to the present day. That means it's a corpus that covers several stages of Georgian, namely Old, Middle, and Modern Georgian. I will talk about that a bit more in detail. And this has some implications as to the question of thematic subcorpora, because, as I will try to show you, the very concept of the diachronic corpus brings about the necessity of considering intrinsic or internal thematic subcorpora that are simply dictated by the materials we have. This is genre-based subcorpora, source language-based subcorpora, style-based subcorpora, and other variation. I will talk a bit about how to deal with that in a diachronic corpus context, namely mostly by applying header information, but also applying metadata beyond or outside of headers. Please feel free to ask any questions in between. We have plenty of time today, so we can get any way into details wherever you like. So we'll be talking about the historical development of Georgian, and most of you will know that Georgian has had some stages in its history, beginning with the Old Georgian period by about the 5th century of our era. Some people distinguish a Middle Georgian period, not everybody does, a Middle Georgian period covering the time from the 12th up to the 18th century, and then the Modern Georgian period from the 18th century up till the present day. This is a very simplistic view, because if we go into details, we will see that we have to make some more historical stages out of this. Within Old Georgian, you know that there was a Hanmeti period first, a period that was distinguished by the appearance in verbal forms and in also some nominal forms of additional kh letters, and this was a period from the 5th to the 7th century. Then we had a High Meti period by about the 7th and 8th century, and then only we have what we can call standard Old Georgian from about the 8th to the 12th century. Within standard Old Georgian, we can still distinguish different stages and different layers, like the Georgian written on Mount Sinai in between the 10th and the 13th century, or the Old Georgian as written in the texts of the Gelati school, which extended from the 11th to the 13th century. And Old Georgian, this is a peculiar thing, was also used nearly until the present day, namely in contexts that have to do with religion, ecclesiastical context. This is what we may call late Old Georgian, because this was written at a time when nobody spoke that language anymore, but this was only used for writing. At the same time, between the 12th and the 18th century, Middle Georgian can be distinguished by peculiar linguistic features, peculiar syntactical features, but also peculiar features in the formation of nouns and verbs. And this is, of course, the language that was introduced with texts like Shota Rustaveli's epic or the Visramayana, and this extends up to nearly the modern period in the 18th century. Then comes the modern period, and this, of course, can also be distinguished at least in three periods, namely a Tsarist period up to the beginning of the 20th century, then the Soviet period within the 20th century, and contemporary Georgian after the independence of Georgia after the year 1990. The difference may be lexical, so we're only within the Soviet period you will find a certain type of words that were only restricted to Soviet communist thinking, and this differed from Tsarist times when Russian influence was also there, but in a bit different way, and today Russian influence, of course, has decreased. So there are differences in all these stages, and this is not the only stages that we can list. This is a picture showing you the very peculiar development of Georgian throughout time, written Georgian and spoken Georgian. If you take the diagonal line, this would be the normal development of a language that is spoken and only spoken and not written. That means it changes a bit over all times until the present day. In written history, it begins with what we have in green. This is the Hanmeti period, then we have the Haimeti period, then we have the standard Old Georgian period, extending further into the modern times, because standard Old Georgian was still written. But at the same time, we have the Middle Georgian period here and the modern period here. So you see the in a written corpus, of course, the language development is visible in a different way from the development of the spoken language. We can assume that the spoken language developed a bit like this because the written language always has some influence on the spoken language, so it's not just a diagonal line which is to be expected, but of course spoken and written Georgian were always a bit distinct. They were never exactly the same, and all this has to be kept in mind when building up a diachronic corpus. Yes? Ideal would be the ideal development without any influence of writing. That would mean ideal, only spoken. I could have written only spoken or something like that. But it's different from the curve that you see, which was influenced by writing. Okay? Yeah. Good. So what data do we have for the diachronic corpus of Georgian? We do have electronic databases covering nearly all published materials of Old and Middle Georgian today, because the efforts to reach this point have started already in the year 1985 in the projects that are called Titus and Armazi. And all this material that we have been collecting ever since has now been introduced into the Georgian National Corpus and is available online now since 2014. For modern Georgian, we also have lots of electronic materials available. Paul Meurer, whom many of you will know because he was also present on some of our summer schools and winter schools before, Paul Meurer developed since the year 2000 a comprehensive corpus of modern Georgian, mostly based upon web pages, but also web pages containing literary texts and whatever, journals and so on. This was called Gecko. And the Gecko material, as well as the material from the Georgian dialect corpus that has been compiled here in Tbilisi by Marina Beridze. Is she here now? No, she isn't. Okay. Since 2008, this has also been incorporated into the Georgian National Corpus. And of course, a dialect corpus brings about new problems because this is not so much a matter of stages in the historical sense, but the matter of variation across the spoken language of today. And then another aspect comes in, and this aspect is that even within the historical stages which we are dealing with, there is not the same type of written material available throughout history. When we begin with the Hanmeti and Hanmeti Haimeti, Haimeti period, Standard Old Georgian, Sinai Old Georgian, and Gelati Old Georgian, this is the abbreviations for what I've been talking about before. This is Late Old Georgian, Middle Georgian, Early New Georgian, then Soviet Georgian, and present-day Georgian. Then you can see that the distribution of different text genres is very different. What do the abbreviations mean on the left-hand side? Text materials that we have from the oldest times are mostly religious, as you know. It begins with Bible translation. This is the first element. Bible translations have been undertaken throughout the history, except for the Middle Georgian period. There is not one new attempt to translate the Bible in the Middle Georgian period, if not according to the standard of Old Georgian. You might know, for example, the Bible by Sulhan Saba Orbeljani, which is the so-called Mtsreta Bible, or you might know the Bakar Bible, which was the first printed Bible in Georgian. These were Bible versions that were produced by the end of the 17th and in the middle of the 18th century, but not according to the language that was used or spoken at that day, but according to the rules of Standard Old Georgian of the 12th century. So this is what we call Late Old Georgian and not Middle Georgian. I don't think there was an attempt to provide a new Bible translation in Soviet times. If you know any, I don't know. This doesn't matter very much because the differences in the peculiar genre of Bible translation is still peculiar till the present day, so even the latest attempts to provide new translations are not very different from what you have had 100 or 150 years ago. So the next genre is hagiography, that means lives of saints. This is also a genre that we have already in Hanmeti times, and this is very different from Bible because it's not so much regulated by the influence of a language from which a Bible was translated. Most of the hagiographic texts were also translated, but not all of them. And so here you have the first text that may be autochthonic text, that means texts that were produced by Georgians first and not translated from Greek or any other language. Okay? Next genre is homiletic texts. Homiletic texts are texts preaching in churches, used for explaining theological aspects of the Bible and whatsoever. And this is also a genre that begins in Hanmeti times, and you see that continues down to the modern age. Then we have theological commentaries, not in the Hanmeti time, but beginning in Standard Old Georgian times. We have historiographical texts. Historiographical texts like Kartlis Tsovreba, which you all might know, but also some other texts that are in between hagiography and historiography, like, for example, the legend of St. Nino, which is, by its genre, a hagiographical text, but which contains very much historical information that is also available in Kartlis Tsovreba. And on the other hand, the Georgian Chronicle, of course, also contains very much hagiographical material because it deals with many saints. Then we have philosophical texts, beginning also in the standard Old Georgian period by the 9th or 10th century. Philosophical texts translated either from Greek or even from other languages, but also philosophical texts that were authored by Georgians for the first time. We have documentary texts, documents like charters and whatsoever. That means charters that were used for contracts or whatever in historical times. Then we have epigraphical texts. Epigraphy is dealing with inscription. And this again is a genre that we have already in Hanmeti times. You might know that there are about 50 or so inscriptions within Georgia that belong to the Hanmeti period. Then we have scientific texts concerning, for example, astronomy, astrology, if this is science, which you might doubt about, then of course something like mathematics or chemics and even linguistics, and we will deal a bit about that later. Then we have journalism, and this is actually a modern genre. You see that this does not begin before the modern Georgian period. Journalism, newspapers and other journals. We have prose texts in the sense of romances and so on. And of course we have poetical texts, and this begins in the Middle Georgian period, and poetical texts even a bit before, if you count something like text by Ioannes Osime on Mount Sinai, who wrote about the praise of the Georgian language. If you count this as being poetical, then we do have poetical texts from before the Middle Georgian period. So we have very different textual materials, very different according to distinct features that they have. We have narrative texts in the proper sense. Hagiographical texts are normally narrative. We have texts that are argumentative, that means texts that try to explain something and to argue different opinions, like theological texts or journalism and so on. And all this must be taken into account when trying to build up a diachronic corpus. Any questions as to these this full set of genres that we have to deal with? Okay, so let's get through them a bit more in detail, genre by genre. As I said, we do have biblical texts right from the beginning, that means Bible translations of New Testament and Old Testament texts, but not only. One subtype of biblical texts is lectionaries, that means texts in which the parts of the Bible that were read during the services in church are collected. So this is practically the same material as the Bible texts themselves, but it's a bit different, and it may be a bit different because this was meant to be read openly, whereas Bible texts were read privately. So there is a big difference that might apply to the style of those texts. And apocryphal texts that did not pertain to the Bible proper because they were not declared to pertain to it, but they have quite the same style, at least for parts, but they may have different sources, and this is why this is an important subcategory. As I said, we have commentaries on the Bible, complete commentaries translated from Greek, for example, for the Gospel of Matthew or for the Gospel of John. Most of this has been published, and this is also part, of course, of the diachronic corpus. Homiletic texts, you remember, this is sermons, this is what people preached in churches. This has been collected in collective volumes like Mravaltavis or Krebulis or whatsoever, and they have a peculiar style, at least if they pertain to a certain topic or to a certain part of the Bible or whatever. Hagiographical texts, a very important distinction, as I said, is that between autochthonous texts, that means texts that were produced in Georgia by Georgians in Georgian language for the first time, whereas most of them were translated either from Greek or from other languages, for example, in the so-called Kimeni collections. Then historiographical texts, I've already mentioned Karis Chovreba, but this is only one compilation, and there are other historical texts that never went into the compilation, into the collection, but must be dealt with separately. Among philosophical texts, we might mention Neoplatonist texts, that means the Neoplatonist school that was quite en vogue in Georgia, at least in the 12th and 13th century, and this was a group of texts that were mostly produced by the Gelati school in western Georgia, and this has a very peculiar syntax and also very peculiar words, as you will see. So this is an important subgenre. Among genre-based subcorpora for later Georgian that we might constitute, first of all, we have epical texts, Rustaveli's epos is the starting point, and something like Oma Inyani is a continuation of it. But there are other epical texts that try to copy what Rustaveli wrote or that try to go into different directions. This would be a nice subcorpus. Other subcorpora could comprise something like romances. Visramiani is the first romance that you have in Georgian history. This is a translation from Persian, but nevertheless it's quite a new genre in comparison with whatever you had before. And there are others following it, like Rusudaniani and so on. Among hagiographical texts, a new genre that appears in later Georgian is metaphrastical hagiographical texts. That means texts that have been re-narrated. Most of the old Georgian hagiographical texts that were translated from Greek or from other languages pertain to, so to say, a language that was a bit old-fashioned even in the 13th century, and so people try to re-narrate those texts, and this is what we call metaphrastical. Among historiographical texts, well, Katlis Tsovreba, the Georgian Chronicle, goes on into the next centuries, in up to the 18th century, and so new parts of Katlis Tsovreba were added. And this has the peculiar effect that if you take the Georgian Chronicle Katlis Tsovreba as one text, then this is a text that mirrors the diachronic development of the Georgian language in itself, because it consists of subtexts that pertain to different stages of the language. It's a peculiar problem. Scientific texts, well, for example, we have geographical texts. You might know the geography of Georgia written by Vachushti Batonishvili in the 18th century. And this, of course, is a peculiar thing because it's a text accompanied by maps. And maps could be part of a corpus, of course, but this is a very peculiar genre. How to describe a map as a text? That's a peculiar question. Others were Ione Bagrationi and others. And we have the first grammar texts. Well, actually, the first grammar text in Georgian was much earlier, was a text translated in the 12th or 13th century. But grammar as a discipline arises in Georgia, as you will know, with Antoni Pirveli and Platon Yoseliani and other persons writing in the 18th and 19th centuries. Then, reporting texts, I already talked about journals and newspapers and so on. This is a genre that is developing, beginning with Tsarist times, beginning with the 19th century, and of course extending in what you have nowadays, and ending up not only in printed texts, but of course also in texts that are not printed, or not meant to be print in the from the very beginning, but that are simply distributed online or however. Another important distinction that we have to make in this diachronic corpus is that so many Georgian texts during its history were translated from other languages. And every single language that you translate from leaves a bit of its traces in the translated texts. So, of course, we do have autochthonous texts, but not very early. The first autochthonous texts that we have are texts in inscriptions. Inscriptions are not translated normally, and so you can expect Hanmedi inscriptions to be the first autochthonous texts. All other Hanmedi texts that exist are translations, and the same holds true until the Standard Georgian period. Translations can be from Greek. This is the most frequent source. This concerns Bible, homiletics, hagiography, philosophy, and even others. Translations can be from Armenian. This also concerns parts of the Bible. It concerns parts of homiletic texts and hagiography. They can be from Arabic. This concerns homiletics and hagiography at least, maybe even a bit of philosophy. It's not quite clear, but maybe there are even some translations from Syriac, from Coptic, and from Latin. Most people deny Latin as a direct source for translations, but sometimes it's very difficult to realize whether a text that exists in Latin, but also in Greek, that the text was translated via the Greek or directly from Latin. It cannot be decided in all cases. The same is true for texts that exist, for example, in Greek and in Armenian. Sometimes the translation might be from Armenian or directly from Greek or from one language via the other. Then we have translations from Persian. This concerns epics and romances from the Middle Ages, but also historiography and documents, charters. We have translation from Ottoman Turkish, and this contains mostly charters, documents. We have, in later periods, translations from Russian, charters again, but also romances, sciences, and of course news and whatsoever. And nowadays we have translation from German, English, French, and what other languages you might want to see here, Chinese maybe. So, as I said, we can expect that the source language leaves some traces in the translated material. And on the other hand, it might be interesting to analyze a given corpus with respect to the question whether you can see in a text what source language it was translated from. So, if we don't know yet what traces Greek or Armenian or Syriac or Arabic would leave in a Georgian text that was translated from those languages, then let's analyze the texts in the corpus from about whom we do not know which language they were translated from, whether we see some differences. What differences might this be? Might be, for example, the difference of the use of pronouns, because Greek uses pronouns in a different way than Armenian does. Greek has articles, Armenian has postponed articles, Arabic has an article but only a definite one, so you might find some traces, but these must be looked upon. And if you want to look upon this, then of course the source language must be indicated in the corpus, and if you don't know the source language, then you must build up a subcorpus of those texts of which you do not know the source language, but you know they were translated. Okay? And yet another distinction must be made that has some relevance for building up the corpus and building up a subcorpora. The first distinction is between prose and poetic texts. Poetic texts always have very different structures from prose texts. Most of the genres we have been dealing with before were genres that are written in prose. Poetic texts are not very many. We do have written poetic texts since about the 12th century. These are narrative texts, epics. Epics are narratives, but in the epic form, in the poetic form, it's a very peculiar genre. We have laudatory texts like eclogues and odes. You might know the ode to Queen Tamar or something like this, and this is also a very peculiar genre. And we have expressive texts, poems written to address a beloved person or satires or whatever. In comparison with that, the genres of written prose are very many more. Again, we have narrative texts, fictional texts, dramatic texts concerning theater and opera is a new genre appearing maybe in the 18th century. Then we have applicative texts, commentaries, philosophy, sciences, documentary texts, inscriptions, jurisdiction and charters, reporting texts, and of course we also have texts of personal communication, letters. We were just asked a few weeks ago to help with the transcription of letters from the 7 years war between Prussia and Russia, because during that war there were also some Georgians involved, among others David Guramishvili, and he wrote some letters to Georgia in his handwriting, and this is a very interesting, peculiar genre, and we hope to publish these letters soon. And then we have only, until now, talked about written texts. Then we have the distinction between written and spoken texts. Spoken texts can be put into the corpus beginning with the 20th century. Why not before? Because everything that we have from before we only have because it's written. There are no recordings of spoken Georgian before the year 1900. The oldest recordings I know of are from the year 1909. So spoken texts we do have since the beginning of the 20th century are either monologic or dialogic texts. And then again, you get different genres that must be dealt with, like narratives, texts concerning personal history or local history or remembrances, explicative texts like explanations on customs or on everyday life, discursive texts like speeches and, very important in Georgia, toasts, dramatic texts like arias from operas or whatever, musical texts, folk songs and art songs, and they, of course, are combinable and combined with music. Dialogic texts can be interviews concerning any question you might have, conversations in everyday life, discussions about whatever you like, or dramatic texts, that means theater dialogues or dialogues from operas. If you want to integrate all this into the corpus, then of course the different genres appearing here must also be addressed. Talking about spoken Georgian, and I've addressed this some minutes ago, we also have variation that is not variation of the standard language, but variation from the standard language. That means differences versus the standard language. That means dialects. You know that Georgian has Eastern and Western dialects. Eastern dialects like Kartlian, which is spoken here, and Kakhetian, and Tushian, Ingilo, and so on. Western dialects like Imeretian, Gurian, Ajarian, or Chweneburi, spoken in Turkey, are quite different. And in the spoken material, that means especially in the Georgian dialect corpus, of course, the materials must be exactly subdivided into which dialect they pertain to. But this is not the only thing we have to keep in mind. But we also have sociolectal variation in spoken Georgian. Sociolectal variation is, for example, met with when the speech of Jews is concerned. Of course, most of the Jews from Georgia now live in Israel, and this gives a new subgenre, namely Georgian, Jewish Georgian spoken in Israel, that might already be different from Jewish Georgian spoken in Georgia. On the other hand, we have argos like the speech of thieves and drug dealers and so on, and we made some recordings in some former projects that we undertook here in Georgia. So materials are there, but they show Georgian in a different shape, and so they constitute subcorpora in their own right. So what I wanted to show you until now is that the material itself gives you the opportunity, or I would even say forces you, to consider that certain parts of the big diachronic corpus are subcorpora in their own right. They may be thematic in the sense of this is philosophy, this is historiography, this is narrative, this is poetic, this is epic, or whatsoever. And they can be then, of course, additionally be aligned in stages pertaining to the history of the Georgian language. This makes the diachronic corpus so complex, and this requires a special treatment in order not to lose yourself among the data you have. The Georgian National Corpus so far comprises something like 150 million words, which is quite a lot. It's one of the biggest corpora that have been assembled throughout the world. But if you consider all these variations that we must deal with, then you might think, and you are right, that some of the subcorpora presenting itself in the diachronic corpus are not as big as the others. So there is very much variation in size and in extent over time in this corpus. Okay, any questions as to this point? Because now I want to deal with the question how we can cope with these different types of subcorpora that must be dealt with in our national corpus. The most easy and most widespread approach to differentiate different texts that pertain to a large corpus is using header information. I know that some of you have already been involved in providing headers for the diachronic corpus. May I ask who of you have already used the header editor that we have programmed for this purpose? Nobody's present here? Okay, anyway. Header information is information that must be added to every single text that you add to a big corpus. Header means it's something like a title, but it's not only the title of the text, it contains very much more of metadata for every single text. It must comprise information as to the linguistic variety the text pertains to, whether it's Khan Mehdi Old Georgian, High Mehdi Old Georgian, Standard Old Georgian, or whatsoever. It must contain information as to the dialect and the sociolect, if this is a spoken text from modern Georgia. It must comprise information as to the question whether the text is autochthonous, produced in Georgian for the first time, or whether it's translated. It must contain information as to the author of the text, if you know him or her, the title of the text, if there is a title, the time when it was authored or written or spoken, and the place where, and then again the source language if it was translated, and the translator if the person is known, time and place of the translation. All this is important information because it constitutes subcorpora in their own right. The header must contain information as to the genre, historiography, hagiography, epic, romance, charter, or whatever a text may be styled as. And, of course, also the style, whether it's a written text or a spoken text, whether it's prose or poetics, and all the other information that you can add. Manana Tandashvili will talk about the header structure much more later on during this winter school, so I will be short on this. The system we use for the Georgian National Corpus is based upon a quasi-standard that has established in the past 10 or so years. It was compiled by a group of corpus linguists who called themselves the Text Encoding Initiative. It exists since 1987, and they have produced guidelines for the electronic text encoding and interchange. And the present stage of the guidelines is called P5, because this is proposal number 5, has been valid since 2007. All this structure that they propose, it's a proposal, it's not a prescription, because they cannot force anybody to use it, but people who use it can use the proposal. And this is all based upon XML. XML is extensible markup language, which is a way of annotating texts that has been established since 1998. It consists of tags, starting tags and end tags, and also empty element tags. You will see some examples later. Tags and attributes. And this is practically enough if you want to encode all the information that you have. Headers are a special subtype of text which only contains metadata on a text that it pertains to. And this now is a short view on our header editor. As I said, I don't want to get into detail as to everything that is contained in it, but Manana Tandashvili will explain this later. Just to give you some ideas. Here you have some entry fields for giving the text a title and a short title. Some texts have very long titles, especially older texts, and so sometimes it's reasonable to shorten this to one or two words, and this is easily done. Then people who dealt with the text, who have the right of being called the author of the electronic version or whatsoever, or the author of the header structure. Then something as to the rights concerned with the given text. The given text can be open for the public, or it can be restricted in usage due to copyright reasons or whatsoever. This can be entered on the second, on the right-hand side of this form. Next side of the header, editor, gives information as to the provenance of the text and its genre. Provenance means provenance by time and place. So, for example, this is Shushanik Istzameba, which most of you will know, is a text from about 476 to 482, if we are not mistaken. It was written in Old Georgian, and then come additional information onto the manuscripts that contain the text. That means a text is not part of the corpus simply by itself, but of course via the written medium that it could be taken from, and this is lastly manuscripts. So there is much information about the manuscripts that contain the text. Then on the right hand side you have some genre elements that you can choose from, like religion, then hagiography, which pertains to religion, and then autochthonous hagiography, and so on. The next header is empty here because this is for translated texts. Shushanik Istzameba, well, some people believe it was translated from Armenian. If you don't believe it, then leave it open because it was not translated. So if it's not translated, then you needn't enter here who was the translator, when was it translated, where was it translated, and from which language was it translated. This has two parts. The next part is also open because this is only for inscriptions. Because for inscriptions, you need very much different information as for texts that have been transmitted in manuscripts or in printed books. Because transcriptions pertain to a given place, whereas a book can be transported anywhere and it doesn't matter so much where it actually is. An inscription needs to have the information. This is an inscription that can be found in Bolnisi or wheresoever, and so all this information must be collected for the header of inscriptional texts. And this also consists of two parts. Then the next is again fulfilled here. This is the header concerning the actual basis of the electronic text. Actual basis means this is Shushanik Istzameba, but you do not quote directly Jakob Zurtavelli, who was the author of Shushanik Istzameba, but what you quote is a scholarly edition of the text, namely the edition by Ilya Abuladze and others in a volume on hagiographical texts. So the actual source where the electronic text was derived from can be indicated here. And lastly, the history of the electronic text. The electronic text was first conceived in 1988. This was quite early for Georgian, and at that time it was not so easy to deal with Georgian on a computer, but it was already possible, and so this text has a long history. And then it went through different stages of corrections and amendments, so that finally the stage arrived now is the addition of this text to the Georgian National Corpus. This is quite a lot of material that must be entered for every single text in order for the National Corpus to be consistent. Consistent means that for every single text I can automatically adduce it to a certain subcorpus, which is thematical according to its contents, or which is based upon other features, like the feature of the source language, or the feature of the century when it was produced, or the feature of the place where it was produced, and so on. And you will see that this is actually very important to have. This is just to give you an idea how the header structure actually is in the corpus. What you've seen is the header editor. This is the way how to enter the information. But in the corpus, this is an XML structure, and you see the typical way XML texts are tagged. That means there is always information in brackets, given like something like name, and what comes is the name, and this means this is end of the name. So this is typically XML. That means you can define all kinds of entities, like names, personal names, and this can be very explicative, or it can be rather enigmatic. But this is not your task to know about. If you use the header editor, then this will automatically produce the correct tags for this XML structure. Okay? Good. So now we can look into our corpus. As I said, the Georgian National Corpus is available online now. Who has already used the corpus for some purposes? Okay, not so many. Well, the address is twofold. You can use the corpus here in Tbilisi because one corpus server is in the National Parliament Library. And hopefully this works now every day. We had some periods in the beginning when it got lost for 2 or 3 days because there was a problem with electricity or whatsoever. But now it seems to work continuously. The address is gnc.gov.ge. That's enough, and the rest will be automatically found. The other address is in Norway because the corpus constructor, Palmøre, has the same thing also on a server in Norway. It's always good to have important data not just on one computer or one server, because one server can lose its data or it can simply crash down. And so here we have a mirrored system. That means everything that is there here in Tbilisi is also there in Norway, and we can also add other mirrors. A question? No. I thought so. You can see the 7 real subcorpora first grade, so to say, that we have in the Georgian National Corpus. This is Georgian National Corpus Old Georgian, National Corpus Middle Georgian, National Corpus Modern Georgian. Then GRC. GRC means Georgian Reference Corpus. This is all modern Georgian, but without any additional information. That means without the header information and so on. This is on the pre-stage, I would say. You can use it for searching just to have an idea of a certain word appears often or not so often, but it's not reliable data. It's just for easy reference into the total amount of data we have, and you see at present it's even more than 150 million, it's 182 million words in it. Then we have GDC, which is the Georgian dialect corpus. We have SSGG, which is the data, spoken recordings from our project on the sociolinguistic situation of present-day Georgia. And then we have started to also build up a small corpus of Megrelian and Swan, derived from the Titus corpora that already exist. But this is just for testing purposes for the time being. One day we hope that we will also have all the header information necessary for every single Mingrelian and Swan text so that this can be part of the real corpus. The corpus can be addressed in 3 languages, namely Georgian, English, and German. So you can choose the language by the tag you have here at the at the top of the page. And then you can choose the corpora you want to work with, either only one or several. You can apply even Old Georgian, Middle Georgian, and Modern Georgian at the same time. And then you have what I call the diachronic perspective, because this will then extend from the beginning of literacy until the present day. Now, as to searches in the corpus, well, the corpus, for most purposes, you will have to search according to words or according to other information. Other information would be information within those tags that mean XML structure that contains information on certain words, like this is a name, or this is a place name, or a personal name, or whatsoever. And you can also search for grammatical features, because everything that is not in the GRC but in the other parts has been analyzed morphologically. This is the query entry Zieba, and you can see that here you can restrict the search even to some subpoints. I wonder whether you can read that on the screen. I will just read it for you. This is, you can search within a certain file, which you then can enter, or within a certain collection, Grebuli, or only the text of a certain author, or only the text of a certain translator, then only text from original historiography, or according to the type of the text. This is all under construction still, but it already works with certain of these elements. And let's try, for example, the search according to certain text types. Here you can search, choose between autobiographical texts, religious text, historiographical texts, scientific texts, and philosophical texts. This is not, by far, not all we want to have. At the end, this must be very much more fine-grained, because we also want to offer the possibility of only to search in hagiographical texts, which are here subsumed under religion, or only biblical texts, or only homiletic texts, or only within philosophy, only Neoplatonian texts, or whatsoever. This must still be programmed, but at the end you will have, you will be able to choose according to all those genre subtypes and style subtypes and source language subtypes that I've introduced so far. Okay? Now this is an example just for one search. Within philosophical texts, I've undertaken a search for Rizhui in Old Georgian. Rizhui number is a term that can appear in every single text throughout history, but if you want to restrict it to philosophical texts, because there it has a peculiar meaning, and when you just look at the examples, you will not be able to read it here, but if you open this for yourself and just do the same search, then you will see that this is really something that has a philosophical background. So very many words in philosophical texts have a different meaning from the everyday meaning of the same word. And you want to retrieve those meanings, then you have to restrict the search to the environment that you want to search in, like philosophical texts. You may note that the word Rizhui in Old Georgian was written with U instead of V. This is one thing. I added a so-called wildcard letter here because I do not want to think of all the case forms that the word might have. So I just give the theme, and this is Rizhu, and then all the individual forms like Rizhuad and others come up. Okay? Then here we have another example from philosophical texts. I once came across the word mravaltaoba in a text. Who has an idea what this might mean? Mravaltaoba. I thought it has something to do with mravaltavi, but it hasn't. It's simply the fact of the word mravalta. The fact that there is the word mravalta is mravaltaoba. And this is in a philosophical text of the Gelati school. And so I thought it might be interesting whether there are other words produced according to the same principle, because I'm a linguist. So words that are derived with the oba suffix from genitive forms like mravalta. And you see that we have at least four examples for this in those philosophical texts. So you can use this for lexicographical investigations, you can use this for linguistic investigations into word formation or whatever, and you can restrict those searches to a certain subgenre like philosophical texts, because you might expect that certain word formations occur only in those texts and not in others. Okay? So, this is all already in the process of being usable, and you can undertake your own searches as you like in the corpus as it is today. But I will now talk about the problem that for certain investigations into the corpus, the header structure will not be enough. Let's remember what the header gives you as information. The header gives you the information whether a text has a certain genre, and which genre it has, whether it pertains to a certain style, whether it's written or spoken, whether it's poetic or prose, whether it's journalistic text, or whether it's a romance, whether it's an epic, or whether it's hagiography or whatsoever, where it was translated from, when it was translated, and so on. All this is in the header, and it pertains to the complete text. But there are many texts that are not in themselves unique. That means they consist of not only one language or not only one genre, and you can simply say they are mixed. And mixed texts are much more frequent than you might think at the beginning. In those cases, of course, a special annotation type is necessary. For example, for special meanings of words occurring in the texts. If you have texts that pertain to the genre of political texts, like, for example, speeches of presidents, then the header gives you the information right offhand. And you can expect that terms occurring in those texts are political terms. But even in the speech of a president, not every term will be political. So it might be important in those texts, even within those texts, to annotate, to mark peculiar terms as being political terms for building up a certain subcorpus. Manana Tandashvili will talk about exactly this topic later on this week. In other contexts, you might want to mark up the same terms in a text that is not political as the whole text, maybe a journalistic text concerning the beauties of Georgia, but sometimes you might find there a political term quoted from the political context, and this would then have to be marked up in order to be found as a political term in the corpus. Another example which I want to show you is scientific terms, namely talking about a linguistic subcorpus in the diachronic corpus. The other thing is mixed language text, texts that are not only Georgian, but they comprise something that is not Georgian in them. This might be other languages of Georgia that are quoted by in a person speaking another language in a Georgian context. And it can also be modern Georgian within old Georgian. And you might wonder how this can come about, but I will show you an example and then you know how. So sometimes it's necessary to mark parts of a text as not pertaining to the header information of the complete text, so that you need special information that must be added in a peculiar way. So this is just to give an idea of how this can be done. We were talking about political terms, and in our project, the political terms are marked up simply first with an XML tag, which means term type is political, and this is Kartveli Eri in this case. Okay, this is a political term in a given political text. Here you can see it a bit better. There might be some reasoning about whether one term is really political and if it differs from other usages of the same term or not. But this is open to everybody, and one idea of such a corpus is that everybody can build up subcorpora in their own right and then add tagging information in their own right for undertaking special investigations into the corpus. And we hope after the final period of our project that this will be a feature, that everybody can build up their own subcorpora and tag them in the way they want to analyze them. So now let's get a bit into linguistic terms. In Georgian history, as I said, linguistics entered in the 18th, 19th century, but there was already one linguistic text or two translated from Greek in the Middle Ages. This is from Antony's Grammar, which was really the attempt of providing a first complete grammar of Georgian. And in the grammar, of course, there are many words that are linguistically used, words that have other meanings elsewhere. And we have tried to mark these up. Marking up means building up annotations, which you can see here, simply rendered by different colors. This is one way to render peculiar annotations. What is behind it, of course, is the markup with XML structures. Here you see it a bit better. This is not from Antony Birveli, but this is from old Georgian text, which was translated from Greek, which is about the Greek articles. The article in Greek, or the word article, is translated by Georgian artroni, which is actually a Greek word adapted to Georgian. And this, of course, is one of the many linguistic terms that occur in this text. But the text was translated from Greek, including Greek elements. So what you see in red here is Greek, because, of course, the Greek article had to be described, and it was described in a twofold way. It was transcribed into Georgian, so ho, tu, to, ton, and so etc. And it was also entered in the edition in the Greek word underlying it. Now, if we have this in a Georgian diachronic corpus, then of course the Greek words must be marked, not only those that are really Greek. They are easy to find because they are written in Greek letters, and so you can search for them simply as being Greek. But what is more important to find is those forms that render the Greek article forms in Georgian characters. So in the Georgian corpus, if you simply search for words beginning with O, then the first word will be O. And this word is not Georgian, but it's Greek, because it's from this text, and it's the Greek article, and it simply doesn't belong to Georgian. So it must be tagged such that it will not be found when searching for Georgian words beginning with O, but it must be found when searching for Greek words in a Georgian context beginning with O. Here you have even complete words in Greek transcribed into Georgian, like ho theos, which means God with the article the God. And this also has been transcribed into Georgian letters, or theos. You see that the transcription is not a phonetic one, because otherwise it would have been ho theos. But at the time when this was produced, the article had already lost its aspiration. So for the time of the 12th or 13th century, this is okay. So the necessity is to really mark up elements that are not part of the language the text is written in. Everything that is Greek in a Georgian environment, or what else you have, like, for example, Persian in St. Nino's legend, then this must be marked up as pertaining to the language of it belongs to. And this cannot be done in the header. The header can only say, this is a Georgian treatise translated from Greek on the article. So it's a linguistic treatise, and it's practically the oldest linguistic treatise you have in Georgian. But in the text, you need to have a markup that marks those words that are not Georgian, but that are Greek in the Georgian context. And this is a peculiar problem that we have to deal with. Okay? So, I still have how much time? Half an hour? Okay, so let's get to one example to show you how important this may be, and especially for linguistic investigations. I personally am dealing with the history of Georgian relative pronouns and relative particles, which is a very interesting topic because, as you will know, Georgian has a twofold system of introducing relative clauses. One is a real relative pronoun, romelits. Today, old Georgian, this was still romeli, romel, or romeliigi. But normally nowadays have Romelits and its case forms, or Vins, Rats, Sadats. This is all other relative pronouns. In contrast to that, you have a shorter Rom, which behaves much different from Romelits. And the question for me was, how old is this Rom? Romeli, Romeliigi, Romelitsa, and so on is plentiful there in Old Georgian. But how old is Rom? So let's try, first of all, to get into this. For those who are not, is there anybody who is not familiar with Georgian? Yes, two persons at least, three persons. So just to give you an idea of the differences between the relative pronoun and the relative particle. Just look into the English Wikipedia. It's peculiar that in the English Wikipedia, in the article on relative clauses, Georgian is used as an example. First of all, with the relativizer that inflects for its embedded case and may take a postposition. This is Romelits. The examples which we have here in transcription, Isk atsi romelts akshi tsavida gazetsk etrulops. This is a beautiful sentence, isn't it? And it contains a beautiful relative pronoun introducing the relative clause. Fine. Can be translated into English as it is. The man who went to the park is reading the newspaper. And it can also contain postpositions, like in the second example, Ninom isk ami romelsets vzivar ikrida. Okay, Nino bought the chair which I am sitting in. You see the difference here between Georgian and English. In Georgian, the postposition ze is incorporated into romelsets, between romel and ze. In English, the postposition or the preposition in comes at the end of the relative clause. But you can also say the chair in which I am sitting. This would be literary style. This is also possible. Okay? But Georgian is good in this. Now, the second more colloquial strategy, which is marked by the invariant particle rom. This particle is generally the second word of the clause, and since it doesn't decline, it is often followed by the appropriately cased third-person pronoun to show the relativized noun's role in the embedded clause. A determiner precedes the relativized noun, which is also usually preceded by the clause as a whole. This reads quite complicated, and for somebody whose language is not Georgian, this is not so easy to learn, especially if your language has only the English or German type of relative clauses. So the examples are Tzeril's Romas Davutzer, Iskali Tbilishits Chovrops. The woman that I will write a letter to lives in Tbilisi. So the problem is that the head noun of the relative clause is Iskali, but it follows the relative clause, and within the relative clause, which contains Rom, the woman is referred to by mas. So the woman appears in form of the demonstrative pronoun in the relative clause, and then she is addressed once again after the relative clause iskali. Rom within the relative clause doesn't take the first position of the relative clause. The first position is tserils, so the letter. This is a peculiar thing which we call the Wackernagel position. Wackernagel was a Swiss a linguist who found out that in very many languages there are some small particles which do not stand in the beginning of a sentence or clause, but in the second position of the sentence or clause, and this is true for Rom in Georgian. Second example, me rom mas zev zivar isk ami ninom ikrida. Nino bought the chair that I am sitting in. And you see that here, again, skami is the head noun of the relative clause. It follows the relative clause, but it's introduced before by mas ze in the relative clause. And rom, again, is in the second position. Such relative clauses may be internally headed. This is the next variant of Rom relative clauses. In such cases, the modified noun moves into the clause, taking the appropriate declension for its role therein, thus eliminating the need for the third-person pronouns in the above examples, and leaves behind the determiner, which now functions as a pronoun in the matrix clause. So, second example, two further examples. Kals romzerdils davutzer is Tbilisi tschovrops. The woman who I will write a letter to lives in Tbilisi. So now you see the head noun kali now pertains to the relative clause, which again has rom, but is after the end of the relative clause refers to the same kali which is in the relative clause. Some people might argue that kali might also be before the relative clause, but as rom always takes the second position in the relative clause, kals must pertain to the relative clause in this context. And this is again the example contrasting with what we had before, tzeril's romas davutzer is kali. Okay, so the question now is, how do these two very different strategies of producing relative clauses, one with a normal relative pronoun, normal in the sense of a European language, and one with this particle in the second position and this introducing before and re-entering the same information after the relative clause again, how that did this develop in the course of time in Georgian diachrony? Some additional features. Again, romeli, as you know, is primarily adjectival, which in contrast to vin, ra, and sada, but you can produce relative pronouns from all interrogative pronouns, who, what, where. All they contain today the relative particle ts from tsa. And the particle can then be moved to the governing noun if you have a genitive relative pronoun. This is not what we are interested in today, because this is all straightforward and it pertains to the normal relative pronoun. However, rom, as a relative particle, never takes the first position in a relative clause. This is what we call the Wackernagel element. If rom occurs in the clause initial position, it is not a relative pronoun. It's a complementizer or a temporal clausal final consecutive conjunction. So you have two different types of rom. One is the relative rom, and one is the rom that is equivalent to English that. He said that, which is a complementizer. Or when he came, this is a conjunction. So we have to distinguish these two types of rom in the history of Georgian, and then find out when came the function of rom as a relative particle about. Question is, did rom have predecessors in older stages? First question can be answered for Middle Georgian. Yes, in Middle Georgian, rom, or a longer form, rome, did exist. This has been the object of the doctoral thesis by Lea Samushia, which she wrote 2 years ago and which will hopefully be published soon. The question is whether rom or rome did also exist already in Old Georgian. In Old Georgian, everybody knows that we had something like a complementizer in the form of rametu. And the question then is, what is the relationship between rametu and rom of modern Georgian? The development of romelits, as I said, is straightforward. This developed from Old Jordan romeli tsa, and this contrasted with romeli without tsa, or romeli with igi, or ege, or esse, or even romeli tsa igi, and sometimes you even have romeli igi tsa. So all these combinations were possible. This can also be addressed in a diachronic sense, so which came first, but even in Khanmeti times you will find all of these different types. I don't want to treat this today. This will be a topic of maybe another occasion. So let's get to the predecessors of rom. Did rom or rome exist in Old Georgian? What do we do? We simply check the diachronic corpus we have by only asking for Old Georgian, for the Old Georgian subcorpus. And we do find five examples of rom in the corpora, contrasting with 55,000 examples of rametu and more than 100,000 examples of romeli, romelitz, romeli igi, romeli esse, and whatever you find. Five examples. And this is peculiar in a huge corpus that has so many relative pronouns. Why only five? And are these five examples correct? So this is the query which I undertook in the Norwegian National Corpus. You see it's very many more. It's not just five. But everything beyond the fifth one is fake. Why? This is ROM, yes, but it's not the particle ROM. It's the abbreviation of the book, the letter to the Romans, by Paul the Apostle. Why is this in the Old Georgian Corpus? Because in the footnotes to the Sinurim Ravaltavi, there are very many references to biblical texts, like, for example, third chapter of the book of Romans, or the letter to the Romans, verses 21 to 22. And all these references have been indexed in the diachronic corpus too. And this is an error, and we must correct it, because this information is not Old Georgian. This is information provided by the editors of Sinurim Ravaltavi, which was, as you know, the oldest dated manuscript of Georgian from 894. And, no, 864, sorry. And of course, in the corpus, that extra information can be there, but this must be marked as being modern Georgian. And ROM in this information must be marked as being an abbreviation for Romans, Romelevi. So this does not work. So simply ignore those cases. This is our fault. When compiling the corpus, we didn't think about that this must be marked in a different way. But you see in this example already how important it is, even within something that occurs as being one text, including footnotes, to distinguish between those parts of the text that are really Old Georgian text and, on the other hand, modern Georgian footnotes pertaining to the text. They pertain to the text, but not in the sense of the corpus. In the sense of the corpus, they are not Old Georgian, but modern Georgian. So let's have a look at the five other examples. The first one you see here, this is present in two text editions of the same text. The text is the life of Saint Sabas. Saint Sabas lived in Palestine in the 5th century. He was the founder of a big monastery there, and the Greek legend of his life was translated into Old Georgian in about the 10th or 11th century in Jerusalem. And this text has been published twice, once by Vakhtang Imnaishvili in the year, I think, 1980-something, and once before by Gornelik Ekelidze in the 1940s. So we do have it twice in our corpus, because we have both editions in our corpus. The text is not the same, however, as you can see. So Vakhtang Imnaishvili text runs, Mašin vertma marad rom zruna stavisi eklesisatvis mospo originelta erculovneba. Well, this is clearly understandable from the modern Georgian point of view, but you will notice immediately that you would not expect Hmertma to appear in an Old Georgian text. You might know that the Old Georgian form would be Hmertman still. Also, you might think that it sounds a bit too modern for being Old Georgian. Okay. Now, the text variant by Gekelidze reads quite differently. Hmertma romelits mudams runastavise eklesisatvis damho originelta erculovneba. You see, there are two differences. Here we have the other type of relative clause with romelits as the relative pronoun, and we have two other words, two different words, namely mudam instead of marad for always, and we have damho in order instead of mospo for destroyed. Okay. But still, this is quite okay from the modern Georgian point of view. All the more astonishingly, we must note that both editions, both Vakhtang Imnaishvili's edition and Gornelik Ekelidze's edition, depend on the same manuscript. They both edited the same manuscript, namely a manuscript from the British Library, the British Museum in London, with the number 11281, and this is a manuscript of the 11th century, which you can easily look into nowadays because the British Library has put it online. Okay, you can do so if you like. Here we can compare the Greek text, and the Greek text has no relative clause, so it doesn't explain why we have two different text versions even in those two editions. What the Greek text has is a participle, pronoumenos, but this is normal that in normal Old Georgian, Greek participles were translated by relative clauses. This is nothing peculiar. The only peculiar thing is we have two different relative clauses here, and both look rather modern Georgian than Old Georgian. Second example, forum. And curiously enough, this is from the same text, and not only from the same text, but from the same chapter in the same text. It's also chapter 89 from the life of St. Sabas, and here we have it, Rom, in both editions, Vachta Gymnasiwilis and Kornelik Ekelizis. Tzmindasionze daupica, Rom ardaitsav sulis tzinats armkopobis dormats. This is the translation, text edition by Vachtang. And a bit different again by Gegelidze, we have Tmidasionze man arut quamas, rom arardaitsavs, arastros sultatsinatsam kopobis dormats. The most important words are the same, but there are differences, like arar instead of ar, or the verb before the rom clause. Now, the Rom clause here is not a relative clause. This is the complementizer clause. You see that Rom is in the beginning of the clause, and it means he swore that. That is not a relative clause, but it's a complementizer clause. In both cases, Greek has hos as the conjunction that has the same function as Rom as a complementizer. So this would be the first example of Rom as being a complementizer in Old Georgian in a text of the 11th century. Third example. Here again, we have a difference between the two editions. In Vachtang Gymnasiwilis editions, you first have a relative clause with Romelitz, and then you have a Rom, again not as a relative pronoun, but also not as a complementizer, but rather as a conjunction together with Ise, Ise, Moatska, Rom, Bevri, Matkani, Episkoposat, Daekrena. So that, or such that, he installed many of them as bishops. Kekelidze's edition has something very different. It simply has a normal sentence, Mravali, Matkani, Man, Akurka, Episkoposat. So there is no subordination here. How can we explain all this? Looking at the Greek doesn't help, because Greek only has two sentences coordinated with kai, meaning and. Okay, we have three examples out of five, not only from one text, but from one chapter of the life of St. Sabas. This is very peculiar. We have the same manuscript, but different texts in the two editions. Why? The reason is quite simply to find. This is the same thing again? No. The reason is that this one chapter is on a page that was missing in the manuscript. And both editors said, well, it's not so good to have the complete text except for that one chapter. The first three or four words are there, the last two or three words are there, but the chapter in between is just missing because in the manuscript one page is missing. So what do? I enter a translation of my own at that position. Gekelidze did this on the basis of a Russian translation of the 19th century, and Vachtang Gymnasiwili did this on the basis of the Greek text in cooperation with colleagues from the classical department of this university. This was indicated in Vachtang Gymnasiwili's edition in a footnote at the end of the whole chapter. In Gekelidze's edition, it was only indicated in the introduction of the book. So it was not marked up in the edition, and this is why it was not marked up, in our computational text, except for some parentheses. And so, we would have done something else if we had known when we entered the text. We would have marked all this text as not being Old Georgian, but simply Modern Georgian, because both authors translated not into Old Georgian. They could have tried to, but they didn't want to. They translated into Modern Georgian. Now, luckily enough, the text exists in another manuscript that was not accessible to neither Vakhtang Imnaishvili nor Korneli Kekelidze. This is a manuscript from Mount Athos. And luckily, I received some photographs of the pages that contain that chapter in the manuscript from Mount Athos. And now we can read how this passage here runs actually in Old Georgian. This is the third one which we looked at, where Rom is combined with Ise in Vakhtang Imnaishvili's translation. The text here has simply coordinative da and, just like the Greek text which we've seen before, which had kai, because this is just a normal translation from Greek. But let's look at the other two examples. No, here you can see the text from the manuscript. This is a well-readable manuscript also of the 11th century. Maybe it's even a bit older than the manuscript from the British Library, so that it's a bit more reliable, and it has the page that is missing in London. The other two examples, we had Rom as a complementizer. In the Old Georgian text in Mount Athos, we read Vitarmed instead, which is one of the two complementizers that Old Georgian possessed. The other one is Rametu, but here we have Vitarmed. So, Epuza Sions Midas Shina, Abak Onons, Vitarmed Argara, Zeda Adgebodis Originelta. You see, Originelta is there in both cases, that is the sect of Origenians, but the rest is clearly Old Georgian with Vitarmed as being the actual complementizer. Here you can see that Vitarmed is written as an abbreviation, as always, in Old Georgian. I have never seen the word spelled out completely. And the third example, which was the first from which we started, with Rom as a relative pronoun in Vakhtang Imnaishvili's translation. What we have here is very peculiar. We have Romeli, which is a usual relative pronoun in Old Georgian. But if you look into the manuscript, you see that the manuscript was edited by somebody, because the relative clause holo romerti romeli maradis irutsis ecclesiata twis ganakarva originelta igishet kmulebai. The relative clause was deleted, not the relative clause. The relative pronoun was deleted in the manuscript. It stood here in the beginning, but it was deleted, and also was deleted the postposition twis after ecclesiata. So somebody worked with the text, and maybe he just wanted to bring it closer to present-day knowledge or whatsoever. Anyway, you can see still the remnants of Romeli here. Romeli, as a relative pronoun, was always abbreviated R-L-I, and this is what stood here before it was erased. So, we can conclude in this text, the life of St. Sabas, Rom does not exist. This is only Modern Georgian and only in one of the two or both modern editions, where the one chapter was added later by a Modern Georgian translation. We still have two examples. What is the remaining examples of Rom in Old Georgian? Rom really appears in written form in an Arabi from Jerusalem, which was edited by Elena Metrevelli in a big book on the documents of the Monastery of the Holy Cross in Jerusalem. This is Arabi number 112, and it reads, Da oris prurisa danacheveris zetik idev Golgotas sheitana rom movida mashin. You see, rom here is actually the conjunction. And again, he brought oil for 2.5 gold coins to Golgotha when he came there. So, what is an Arapi? This is something like a note for certain persons that may be mentioned during divine services in order for to be prayed for them or whatever. And the person that is concerned here is a person that lived in the 16th century. Actually, the terminus postquem, that means after which this must have been written, is the death of the person, because Arapis are always connected to dead people. So the death of the person in question was in 1567. So the Arapi cannot have been written before. Although all those texts, those minor texts in those documents, in those ecclesiastical documents, were written in Old Georgian, this is not Old Georgian, because at that time people simply did not know exactly the standard of Old Georgian, so that they could introduce something from their spoken language, even if they intended to produce an Old Georgian text. This is exactly the type of late Old Georgian I was talking about. If you look into the Bible versions by Sulhan Saba Orbeljani or Bakari, Bible versions of the 17th and 18th centuries, then you see that they try to provide real standard Old Georgian, but they fail because the rules of Old Georgian were no longer really available to them. And this is also true for those who wrote down these notes. So this cannot be styled simply Old Georgian, but it must be styled late Old Georgian or even Middle Georgian, because the spoken language at that time was Middle Georgian. So again, this is our fault. We should not simply declare these texts to be Old Georgian, but we have to declare them as being late Old Georgian. And the problem is that this is a collection of texts. It's not just one text, but it has one header. The one header said this is Old Georgian because the oldest ones pertain to the 9th or 10th century. But there is diachrony in the collection itself, and so every single text must have its own header. And this is a lot of work to be done. You can ask Eka Quirquelia, who has done this for a collection of other texts from Mount Sinai, and this went up to 300 or something single headers for every single text, okay? And the last example exactly is from the Mtsheta Bible. That means from Sulhan Saba Orbeljani's Bible. Here we have again the conjunction Rom after Amistris for that. Da mesamesa ramesa kurtchava mogenicheba Amistris Rom shvilni twengan arasneuni ishwebian. So this is not modern Georgian, it's not Middle Georgian, it's Old Georgian, except for Rom. So even Sulhan Saba Orbeljani, when he translated the book of Tobit from Latin into Old Georgian, because it didn't exist in Old Georgian before, even then he was not aware that Rom, which he used in speaking, was not part of the grammar of Old Georgian. So even Sulhan Saba Orbeljani's Old Georgian must be styled late Old Georgian or even post Old Georgian. It's not Middle Georgian, it's not modern Georgian. It tries to have the rules of Old Georgian, but it doesn't work. Bakar's Bible, 50 years later, has not Amistris Rom, but Rata. This is not Old Georgian either, because Old Georgian still had Raita with the Y consonant, but Rata is closer to Old Georgian than Amistris Rom. Actually, Old Georgian did possess the book of Tobit in the Bible translation. The Athos Bible or Oshki Bible does have it, but even there this verse is missing, so this was actually a new translation in the case of Sulhan Saba Orbeljani from Latin and in the case of Bakari from Russian. So we have two different translations of the 17th and 18th century of this part of the Bible, and this must be marked up especially. So what are the tagging requirements? I'm coming to the end now. What we need is a consistent distinction of non-Old Georgian elements within Old Georgian contexts, like modern Georgian, a modern Georgian chapter within the life of St. Sabas. We must also have a consistent determination of late Old Georgian texts, and this begins even in the 12th or 13th century. Old Georgian Arabis, like the Jerusalem Arabi, which we've seen in the 16th century, cannot be just Old Georgian. They are late Old Georgian. That means they do contain something that is not according to the standard of, say, Ektvime Mtatsminderli. And this is also true for Saba's and Baka's Bible translations, which are often simply quoted as being Old Georgian. This means that individual headers must refer to this stage of Old Georgian, and we also need text internal tagging for elements that do not pertain to the standard. And this is a lot of work to be done, but this is what we are here for. Thank you very much for your audience. Thank you.